Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I want to thank them for sponsoring the podcast and also want to thank them for sponsoring our new online magazine. Woohoo! This is the project I've been working on for a while. I didn't quite get it right. I've been talking about putting together some stuff and putting it on a website, but I think now what we're doing makes sense. If you go to lovejoy.co.uk and sign up, every Wednesday you'll get a free online magazine, which is made up of knowledge from the experts that I've had on this podcast. There's also original material. We've got letters there. There's a competition. There's books that have changed my life. People are always asking me, give me some good books to read. And so I've made a list of the ones that I've had a real impact on me, made me think differently about the world, books that I think you'll enjoy reading. All the articles are short. It'll take no time to read this. I feel it could be great, you know. I really do. I think it could be something that people will look forward to receiving, just a quick insight from all these experts because I listen back to the podcast and I think, oh yeah, that I forgot about that bit. So it's just a constant reminder of things that we've talked about on this podcast. But I want to know what you think. Please give me your feedback. I'd love to know if you enjoy it, whether you find it useful, and obviously whether it is making you think as well, because that's what it's supposed to do. Give your feedback to me at tim@lovejoy.co.uk, tim@lovejoy.co.uk. And I tell you what, today's podcast hopefully will make you think as well. Today's hour, I'm curious about how donut economics can change the world. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm constantly thinking we've got it wrong. When I say we, I mean humans of the world. On a global scale, it seems it's full of doom and gloom. And on the domestic front, we really have some terrible ideas, don't we, of how to run things. I'm always thinking, are we really doing it this way? But yeah, what am I doing? What are we going to do? Right. Every time I bring this up with friends, they tell me it's just the way it is. Though, does it have to be just the way it is? Kate Raworth has invented a new idea called donut economics, which has gained a lot of interest from the big thinkers in the world. She wants us to change the way we view the world, change the way we view economics. Let's find out more. Here's Kate. Hi, Kate. How are you?
I am really well. Glad to be about to have this chat with you.
Excellent stuff. Well, I'm a bit nervous about doing this, I must admit. And I was thinking to myself, why am I nervous about it? And I think this is really important, actually, because I left school at 16. I'd got just a couple of O-levels. Well, I'd got 6-7 O-levels. But all the way through, I did it actually at economics O-level. And I did quite well in it. But I was told all the way through, that sort of implied that, all the way through my life that, things like economics isn't really for me, the big finance of the world and politics and stuff like that. And the older I've got, the more interested I've got in it and the more I understand. Actually, it's sort of quite basic. It's just made to look really complicated. And then reading through your book, I suddenly thought, wow, actually, this is for me because it's about my life and about the world that I'm living in. And I suppose the first question I'd like to ask you is, what is economics? Because the word to me seems just like a load of diagrams you learned at school, but with economics comes economists. What is the job of it all?
Oh, such a good question. But your story is so resonant with what so many people feel. When I was writing Donut Economics and I was a mum at the school gate waiting to pick my kids up after school, and people would say, "Oh, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm writing a book about rewriting economics." The first thing people do is pull back. They stiffen up and they'd say things like, "Oh, I wasn't very good at maths at school." And exactly like you just said, as if thinking about economics means you've got to do maths and equations and diagrams. Actually, let's go to the ancient Greek roots of this word. Economics comes from these two Greek words, ekos nomos. It means the art of household management. So we've all got a hand in that. We've all got a huge vested interest in that. How do we manage this household? I'm not talking about our individual homes. I'm not talking about our nations. I'm talking now about our planetary household. So let's recognize this is the era for planetary economics. We've got to manage this household. But still, the degree of economics, I think, is way too narrow. It is still calling mathematicians. I know a bunch of students who go to university excited about studying economics, and they drop it after the first year. Because they say, well, it was just all equations. They want to think politically, as we need people to. And it's as if this kind of mathematization of economics is driving the more politically minded, the more socially minded, the more activistic students out, which is a awful filtering out process of those who really want to transform systems. So we have economists, you know, if I say, what's an economist look like? People give this test to kids and they draw probably a man, probably in a pinstripe suit with a briefcase, looks very remote, talking in language that none of us would understand and probably not very interesting. That is so far removed. And that's what I wanted to do with Donut Economics, is actually reconnect it to everybody and say, well, we're all economists. And actually, if you haven't studied economics, you might even have an advantage here, because you've got less intellectual baggage to unload. Your mind is more open to the new ideas. So that was my aim with the book, to make it accessible and relevant to the planetary household of the 21st century.
So what defines an economist then? What are they, and what's their job? Because as you say, when you talk about an economist, that's exactly what I think, a man in a pinstripe suit talking about maths or finances.
Well, a mainstream kind of stereotypical idea of an economist is often doing that. Might be a man, might be a woman, but they're usually talking in monetary values. And I'm going to say that's probably the defining feature, that economics focuses on talking about values in terms of prices. And I think that's because mainstream economics says, welcome to economics, here's the supply and demand curve. And it starts with this diagram that looks at, you know, how many people are willing to supply a good in a market and how many people want to buy it. And the place where those lines cross is the price. So it puts price at the center of our vision and then ends up giving a price to everything. So when in a meeting, if people says, well, we really need the economists here, what they're saying is we need people to come and tell us how much this will cost, how much it's worth, where the money could come from, how it will repay for itself. It's an important angle on the world, but we don't need to talk about everything that matters in those terms. In fact, there's a real danger of turning everything into a price. What I notice as well is when people turn to the economists, there's this almost deference that appears. You know, the American president has this Council of Economic Advisors, and we've all heard of that. Well, he also has Council of Scientific Advisors, but we've never heard of that one. So it's as if the economist has this role whispering in the leader's ear, whispering this wisdom of prices and costs and budgets and deficits and debt and interest rates and inflation and things that are quite scary because they can have huge impacts in our lives, but feel very removed from most people's ability and to understand. So there's a real danger it gets made remote and inaccessible, and then most people think, that's not for me.
And are they geniuses? Do they know the answers?
They do not know the answers. God, if they knew the answers, why is this planet on the verge of ecological breakdown? We have profoundly neglected the most essential parts of life, and economics, if it's the art of household management, it is not managing this household at all well. So no, they don't know the answers. And I think it's crucial to bring in more voices and more diverse visions into economics.
Okay. Well, before we get into that, because I think there's some really fascinating things in your book, but how did you get to where you are? How are you interested in economics? And then what made you think, I need to change the way we perceive it?
Yeah. So like many young undergraduates, I went off to university thinking, I want to help changed the world. I grew up in the 1980s. I saw a hole opening up in the ozone layer. There was a famine in Ethiopia. I wanted to be part of a generation that says, let's fix this. So I thought, if I learn economics, I'm going to learn this mother tongue of public policy. I'm going to get to speak like those people who come in the room with a briefcase and help sort things out. So off I went, and I hadn't studied it at O level or A level. I hadn't done it at school. And so I was on this real catch up when I got to university of trying to learn, the students around me, many of them had done A level. So it was that catch up, quickly learn the concepts. And I didn't question it at first. And then I gradually realized that some of the most fundamental things that I was wanting to study were just really at the margins of the syllabus, like the living world. Oh, yeah, environmental, we can do that in 1 week. We'll have a week on that. By the way, we talk about environmental breakdown as an externality, right? We talk about it as externality because it falls outside the market. And I just think, what we're going to talk about the breakdown of the living world as an externality. What kind of way to talk about it is that? Where was social justice? It just wasn't at the center of what I wanted to study. So I studied economics for 4 years. And then, my professor was saying, why don't you stay on and do a PhD? And I just thought, I just don't feel proud to stick out my hand and say, hello, I'm an economist. I don't want to be one of those stereotypes in a suit with a briefcase talking language that most people don't understand. I don't feel proud of this framing and this way of thinking that I'm learning. So I left and I went and immersed myself in the real world economy. So I spent 3 years in Zanzibar working for the government of Zanzibar. Zanzibar is the Zan in Tanzania, right? It's a small island off the coast of Tanzania. I was working with micro entrepreneurs in the villages for 3 years and women who were managing their household with almost no money in their pockets, a neighbor community forest, raising kids with almost no running water, like people managing in extraordinary circumstance. I spent 4 years working in the UN and this flagship report they put out called the Human Development Report. It wasn't called the Economic Development Report. It was called the Human Development Report. And it really put people at the center of the vision of what economies should be for and nations should be achieving. That really changed the way I thought. And then I worked for Oxfam for a decade, thinking about labor rights in global supply chains and who made the clothes we wear and what are the conditions for workers down those supply chains and how come it can be so cheap for me to buy a t-shirt? Why is somebody being paid total poverty wages and exploitative conditions at the other end of that? And at the end of all this, I just realized that I could not walk away from economics. It had just framed the way I thought about the world. Oh, I also became a mother of twins, right? So I'm suddenly immersed in the household economy, knee deep in dirty nappies for two babies, and really thinking about the relationship between the unpaid work of raising kids and the world of paid work. So I realized all of this was my experience of the economy, and I was never going to manage to walk away from this mindset that I'd been taught. So I wanted to be part of rewriting it. And after the financial crash, when economics students at that time got really embarrassed, right? They go down the pub with their mates and their mates would say, right, so like the economy's crashed. You're studying economics. You explain what's going on. And they all said, well, we can't because the models we're taught, the theories we're taught don't have banks in them. They don't have money as this system that can bubble and crash. And so they got furious by the ideas that they were being taught that just didn't even reflect the reality around them. And the students started creating this movement called Rethinking Economics. And by the way, if anyone's a student or interested in it, I really recommend checking out what the students internationally have been doing. This began brewing up in around 2013, 2014. And I realized there's going to be a movement to rewriting economics. The big economists are coming out saying, we need to rewrite economics to reflect financial realities. And I just thought, I'll be damned if we're only going to rewrite it for that. What about the breakdown of the living world and climate change? What about extremes of social inequality in this country and around the world? Are we not going to rewrite economics to reflect that? And that's what led me to leave my job at Oxfam, which I loved, to go and write a book. I wanted to bring together all the ideas that I had not been taught in my degree, because there were great ideas about complexity economics and ecological economics and feminist economics. And these sound like big complex terms, but it's like saying, what happens if we start by economics by recognizing that we're on a delicately balanced living planet? What happens if we start economics by recognizing that women are performing unpaid caring work, the cooking, washing, cleaning, sweeping that goes on in households every day? What if we put that into our economic models? What if we recognize the economy is complex and there are booms and busts? So what happens when you put all those ideas together on the page? And what, yeah, how do they dance together? And when I started reading them, I just realized there were some brilliant ideas here. Why wasn't I taught this? So I thought, I just want to write the book that I wish I had been taught and that I think students today really deserve these ideas because they're going to equip them so much better than what they're actually being taught on the mainstream syllabus.
Just before we get into talking about donut economics and what it actually means, because that is the name of the book, being a mother of twins, I'm a father of twins, and it's a very good example of supply and demand, one toy, two children. You see them go at it, don't you?
Yeah, they learn the sharing economy very, very early. Ownership, it's not yours. You know, you can have a turn. Don't say it's mine. It's my turn, but it's not mine.
That's so yes. Funny.
Well, if you're, you know, father of twins, you know, it's really intense what happens when you have two small children into your life. Your household income might halve because one parent stops working. The household unpaid caring work more than doubles because there's nappies everywhere. And you're suddenly realizing this your life is based around a time budget. Have you got the babies or have I got the babies?
And
yeah, it was really transformative for me of thinking about the unpaid caring work of parents. And then the day I could put them on a bicycle, the day they turned one, I had this bike where you could put one in a kind of seat at the front and one in a seat at the back. This is
wow.
13 years ago, right? Now these bikes are everywhere now, but it was like my freedom machine. And I suddenly realized when technologies are designed to actually enable people who are caring for other people, that I could carry two babies and some shopping. So it really made me think we live in a world that wasn't designed for a lot of the work and care and needs that actually need to happen. If we can redesign bicycles to make sense and work for families and for parents, can't we redesign the economy so that it works for us as well? And that, yeah, that's a big part of what drove me to write this book.
Yeah, also the thing that I learned about twins was you were just talking about it there, is that a language, actually, the way that a language is perceived, and you can take some language and you can change it or make it. My children used to spend a lot of time saying to the twins, share. So what they would do is one would walk up to the other one, Grace would walk up to Rose, take something off Rose, and then look at her and go, share, and then walk off. And it was just wonderful watching her now use that word in the way she wanted to use it, which is, right, if I say the word share, it works. You know, I can take whatever I want as long as I'm saying share. You sort of say a few things a bit like that in your book. But let's get to the crux of it. Why is it a donut? What does that mean?
Right. So I think pictures really matter, right? We can all pull in our mind, picture the London tube map.
Yep.
And it helps us get around London. Diagrams matter. So I think, well, what is the picture from the economy we've inherited, the picture of success? What's the shape of success? And it's this line of ever-rising growth. It's a curve that goes up, 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 up through the ceiling. Right. And we hear it in our politicians' speeches. Yes, the economy is growing. Growth is back. Green shoots of recovery. Economists and politicians speak, no matter how rich a country already is. And this is a really important point. We live right now in one of the world's richest countries. And yet, even in this country, our economists and politicians believe that the success of this country and economy lies in yet more growth endlessly. There's no end. There's no arrival point. It just goes up, 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 up. So the shape of progress that we've inherited from 20th century thinking is never ending growth. And there's a point to that, right? Growth, talking about kids, growth is a wonderful, healthy phase of life. We love to see our kids grow and our gardens grow, but nothing in nature survives and thrives by growing forever. So we need a new shape of progress. And crazy though it might sound, the one I'm offering, I think of it as a new compass and direction. It is a donut. It's the kind with a hole in the middle. So if you think of humanity's use of Earth's resources, all the timber and soil and fish and fossil fuels and land and fertilizers that we use, if you think of it like radiating out from the middle of a picture, we want to leave nobody in the hole in the middle of the donut. That's a place where people are falling short in the essentials of life. And the hole in the donut is where people do not have the resources they need to have decent food and health and education and housing and income and participation in society, right? Leave no one in the hole. That's get them out to meet their human rights. The whole of the 20th century economy, you could say, actually was focused on that, make sure no one's left in poverty. And we grow our economies to do that. Trouble is, we know too much now. Scientists, actually, almost since 50 years ago, there was a report called Limits to Growth that said, whoa, if we carry on like this, we're going to overshoot this planet. We're going to destroy the life support systems of our planet. And the science has been catching up faster and faster. We've got the climate change scientists, but biodiversity scientists as well. Scientists are now saying there's a limit of pressure we can put on our planet. There is an outer ring to this donut as well. So leave no one in the hole, but don't overshoot the outer crust. Because when we put so much pressure on our planet, when we burn fossil fuels, convert land, apply fertilizer, draw fish from the sea, cut down forests, we start to put pressure on this planet's life-supporting systems. We destabilize the climate. We cause catastrophic species loss. We convert too much land for human use. We create a hole in the ozone layer. We pollute the air and the soil. And the planet can only take so much of this. She's been incredibly generous and resilient till now. But if we keep adding this pressure, there's going to be a point at which the climate just destabilizes and systems shift in ways that are totally inhospitable to human civilization. And that's a big thing to say. It's really catastrophic what we could be pushing ourselves towards, over a cliff that you can't climb back up. So leave no one in the donut's hole, falling short in the essentials of life, but don't overshoot the limits of this life-supporting planet. And that means the shape of progress has completely changed. It's not this ever-rising line of growth and expansion endlessly. It's a dynamic balance between the inside circle and the outside circle. It's about thriving. It's like a breath, a heartbeat. And actually, we already know this in our own bodies, right? So my bodily health lies in balance. I need enough food, but not too much. Enough temperature, but not too much. Enough exercise, not too much. Our body's health, we know deep in our own systems, these complex systems of our body that all interact, our digestive system and our respiratory system and our nervous system and skeletal system, they all need to be healthy and working together. And their health is measured when we're in a good balanced zone. And the doctor will tell us, yeah, you know, you're in a good place on this balance. If we can take what we deeply already feel and know at the level of the human body and now take that metaphorically to the planetary body, so the planetary health also means healthy people within the healthy living systems of this planet. That's the donut. And it's a completely different starting point for, so what does economic success look like? That's the goal. It's not growth. It's thriving within the means of the living planet. And it just means it changes the entire economic mindset and the curriculum. It changes the textbooks from page one.
But society doesn't reflect that either, though, does it? Society, we're taught, I mean, from a very early age, you're taught, be successful, get as much money as you possibly can, grow your business. I mean, everybody at the moment who I know who starts a business to sell it. I mean, it's incredible that people don't start a business because they want to be involved in that business. They go, if I start this business and it gets successful, hopefully Samsung or whoever, you know, Elon Musk or someone will come and buy me and then I can be very rich. And then this is kind of the way that our thought processes work. So wouldn't you have to if we're going with donut economics, don't we have to re-educate everybody in the way they perceive society too? Isn't it just a reflection on what's going on in the world?
So yes, so I would say that wasn't the whole of society you were talking about. You just gave some great examples from the world of business that there is a really strong drive at the moment of this, you know, get a great innovation, create a startup, spin it off, sell it on. That is one attitude towards business that has taken off a lot in recent years. But there's lots of others. I have plenty of friends. I know people who've set up a restaurant. They left their jobs. They set up a restaurant together. It seats about 20 people. That's it. And they love it. And that's their livelihood. And they create a brilliant space in the community. And they don't want to sell it on. They don't want to grow. Why would they want to grow? They don't want to cook all night. They are really happy with what they've created. I know other people are setting up, you know, a wood reclaim company, getting back old timbers, turning it into something else, a retrofit company. They're really happy because they're not setting up a business in order to grow it just to make money and then say, so how much did you make from that? They're setting up a business because they have a purpose. They want to run great restaurant and provide great food and company for people. They want to recycle materials and actually help retrofit houses. That's their purpose. Business becomes the vehicle. So it's two really different attitudes towards what a business is. And actually at the heart of donut economics, when we really go deep, and I'm very happy to do that, but when we really go deep, we go deep, deep into the design of enterprise itself.
How have economists viewed your donut economics?
So some mainstream economists might ignore it because it's so disruptive in a way, because like I said, it changes the textbook and it changes the curriculum from page one. That's quite challenging. What's interested me is the people who've come to it. So people not in the mainstream economics department, but people maybe in development studies thinking about countries around the world and how they're going to develop from a lower income position today. People in architecture, in design, in business studies. That's interesting. The MBAs, right? They come because business happens in the real world. Real businesses have real supply chains, and real supply chains get affected by drought. They get affected by climate breakdown. They get affected by strikes. So they're into it because they can see that this is a space that we need to do business in. Architecture, political studies. So all lots of studies that are embedded in the real world. And so actually when I wrote the book, I thought I want to change the economics curriculum. That's what I want. I was going straight back for where I'd come from. And actually, that's the place where I've seen least direct engagement. So I let go of that because as a mum of young twins, when my kids were little, I just thought, you know what? I have not got time to knock on shut doors. I'm going to go where the energy is. So I would take up every offer that came from whichever university department was asking. And then you get into really, really interesting conversations with the architects, with the urban planners, with the designers who are actually making the cities and the spaces and the businesses of the 21st century.
People hate change, though, don't they? I mean, it's a fundamental problem. You know, whenever I say to people, look, I'm not sure our political system's working anymore, everyone goes, it's the way it is. And you go, well, not really. There's only been 51 prime ministers. You know, it's not a massive, in the great scheme of humanity, it's not that, you know, we could change it now. And, you know, and then in the future, we'll have whatever the new version is in for the next few hundred years. Things can change. But people get very much stuck, like you say in your book, about the old diagrams that were invented back in the last century. We're still stuck with those diagrams, aren't we? People don't like to move away from what they perceive as the norm, even though the world is changing dramatically.
Yeah, and actually, if people hate change, why is everyone going shopping so much, right? People are like, well, I'd love to say, you know, don't change your wardrobe. I think just it's the way it's always been. Just keep the clothes you've got. Don't buy any new. No, people keep going shopping. We actually love change. So I'm going to argue the opposite. People love change. We love novelty. Oh, I'll try this one. Oh, this suits me. We're always wanting to try a new restaurant, read a new book, do a new thing. We are novelty seekers. So actually, I think humans love change. But we are, it's so much easier to argue against the unknown than to try it, right? And I often say change is hardest just before you make it. I'll give you an example. A year and a half ago, our kids are now 13. They can get around by bike. I live in a small city. I just could no longer justify having a car. Why do I own a car? I just need to let it go. It was a diesel car. I think like you, 15 years ago, people said, oh, the right car to get is a diesel car. We've got a diesel car. Oh, no, that's the worst car you can have. Like, let's get rid of this car. So we decided to get rid of it just before Christmas. And I remember calling up the company to say, could you come and take this car away? And it was quite old. So we want it to be disassembled and completely recycled and just off the road. And we're going to join a car club. So we're now a member of a car club. And the woman said, oh, yeah, no, we'll be there in 4 days' time. And then she rang back, oh, we can't come for another 6 days, actually. And I thought, could you just come and take it away? Could you just come? Because just before I was letting go, I'll go and sit in the car and think, oh, this smells of family holidays. This smells of going somewhere with my kids. This seat is comfortable. This is part of my life. Am I really going to let this car go? It works. There's nothing wrong with it. Why am I letting it go? And all these questions, like, why am I letting it go? And it was only when this massive flatbed truck came along and put our little car in the back, oh, there it goes. And it went down the end of the street and it turned right and it was gone. And it was only when it was gone that I could suddenly see this space in front of my house. And I thought, I feel lighter. And we started chalking in that space. We built a snowman in that space. We started using it playfully, but just feeling lighter. And it was only once that change had happened that I could experience the other side of it. So I always think before a change happens, we know everything we're going to lose. We can list it. We can cling on to it. But it's so hard to imagine what we're going to gain. And that, I think, coming back to, you know, political systems or changing the layout of the roads or whether cars or bikes get priority here, or we're so resistant to change because we've made our habits and yeah, we're defensive against it. And sometimes we just have to step to the other side and try it out. There's so much to be gained once we're on that other side. So I always try to remember that for myself. Change is hardest just before you make it. Just take that step. I'm sure we'll look back and say, why did that take us so long to do? Why did it take us so long to get our economy off fossil fuels that pollute our lungs and blacken the buildings and destroy the climate and move to renewable energy? Why, you know, our kids will look back and say, but why did you drag your feet so much, your generation? They won't understand because they'll see the benefits of it that we find too hard to imagine.
I am told, though, and I've heard this on a few podcasts, that actually driving for profit constantly and driving for growth is one of the factors which helps the world. So the examples of that, interestingly, with the car thing, all the big companies like BMW and Mercedes and stuff like that, they're calling themselves mobility companies or something now. And what they want you to do in the future is rent get an agreement with them, and then the cars arrive to you. Then you get on a train. Then you get to the other end of the train, you get either a scooter or you get another car waiting for you, or a bike, whatever it is. You know, there's like a different, very different, they want to buy you in, but they're only doing that because they're perceived with their profits. And the better example that's always given, I think you've probably heard it a load of times, that the reason why the aluminium on a Coke can is so thin now is not because they were caring about the environment, it's because they want to make maximum profits. I've always thought it's bizarre, actually, that we have this tin, and in it is only 330 milliliters of a liquid, which is so bizarre, especially when it's water. But you know, when it's a Coke or a beer, and then you bin it, it's like, what are we doing with that? Like, it's insane. Anyway, the Coke apparently and Pepsi have made their cans really like only because they want profit, and profit drives the future in the right directions. I've listened to a lot of podcasts where they've implied that, and the way to cure the climate crisis is by letting these companies drive towards profit, and that way they will make everything more environmentally friendly because it'll be cheaper. What is there any truth in that sort of argument?
So only businesses that make a profit are going to survive as businesses, right? So making a profit is a fundamental part of what it means to run a company. If you've got no profit, you can't open the doors next week or next month or next year. For me, the real question is, does this company exist in order to make a profit and to make as much profit as possible? Or does this company exist to serve a purpose, and it's got to make a profit in doing that, but that's not where it exists, and it's going to reinvest in its purpose. So actually, I'll come back to that deep design question of donut economics. So whenever I encounter a company, and it might be a company somebody loves or hates, or they say, oh, this company's really transforming and going to be sustainable, and it's doing all the right things, I want to look in the deep design of that company. So we look at five design traits: its purpose, its networks, its governance, its ownership, and finance. So purpose, right? Let's imagine a sportswear company. What's the purpose of this company? Why does it exist? Does it exist to provide people the clothing they need to be out being healthy in the world? How is it networked? So how does it relate? What is its relation to its suppliers, who it's buying from, its own staff, and its customers? And is it reinforcing its own values and what it cares about, what it says it stands for in its relationship with those people? Or is it, like I was talking about the work I did at Oxfam, exploiting people through global supply chains, demanding faster turnaround, paying them lower wages and exploiting those at the other end? That's not in line with its values. How is it governed? So who has voice in the decision-making about whether this company is going to buy up another or expand or bring out new product ranges or invest that extra margin to make a sustainable product or not? What are its metrics of success? Is it the quarterly report, right? Publicly traded companies have to report every quarter on their profits. Is that the metrics of success? How profitable we've been this year? Or is it how much we've transformed and become circular and sustainable and how good wages we're paying people? But let's go deeper, but below the profit, but below the purpose, the networks and the governments. Let's go down to ownership. How is a company owned? And this, I think, is where so much gets decided. There are so many different ownership designs of a company. A company could be owned by its founding entrepreneur. It could be owned by a family. It's been in the family for 200 years. It could be owned by shareholders, by venture capital. It could be owned by the state. It could be owned by its customers or by its employees. These designs all exist. And these very different ownership designs have huge consequences for what sits at the bottom of this five design traits, which is finance, where the money's coming from. Is the money coming from the stock market, in which case the owners, the shareholders, expect that dividend and are going to be looking at the quarterly reports to see the company has growing share and growing profits and growing turnover? Is it owned by and held by venture capital who, like you gave at the beginning, you know, the example, like, we want you to grow and we want 50 times of our money back, so you better be on this massive growth trajectory. Sustainability sounds really nice branding, but actually, come on, this is hard-nosed business now, because that's what we want from our venture capital. Is it owned by a family that might say, this has been in our family values for hundreds of years and we're going to steward this company with the legacy of our family and our values really matter? Is it owned by its employees who say, actually, what we want this company to do is be to generate profits and reinvest them to make this a good place to work. So how a company is owned and therefore financed has a huge impact on its purpose and on how profits are distributed, whether they're reinvested in that purpose or whether they're extracted and paid out to the owners. And whether that company therefore says, well, obviously we have to grow because that's why we're in business, to generate dividends and returns for the owners. Or they say, no, we don't have to grow at all because we're owned as a small family restaurant and our purpose is to provide a great restaurant in our neighborhood and we're succeeding in that. And let's actually reinvest. Let's buy a new coffee machine. Let's make serve even better coffee. That's what we're going to do with our profits. So there are so many different designs of business. I don't at all agree with the idea that, oh, business pursuing profit, that's what's going to take the world to sustainability. If we go for that model, we say, you know, just let businesses, let rip, go for profit first. We have to design a set of regulations in the world that take care of every single thing that matters, because otherwise business will just keep pushing up against it and trying to make a profit against it. You have to put in so much regulation around what you can and can't do around the living world that you'd have to make what businesses love to call red tape. You'd have to make so much environmental and social protection, because otherwise business is like this tiger trying to get out of the cage. You have to make a really tight cage. I would much rather design business that has within its ownership a stewardship idea of why we exist as a business and a social purpose and an ecological purpose, responsibility of what we're trying to make happen in the world, rather than say we're just here to maximize profits and therefore it's actually our responsibility to push back against red tape. It's our responsibility to our shareholders to make sure the government rolls back those regulations so we can make even more profit for them. Because you get businesses doing outrageous, totally anti-social, anti-planetary things in the name of maximizing profits. So I think it was Milton Friedman who said, you know, maximizing profit is the social responsibility of business. And that was in the 1970s. And I think we can leave it there. We are in a completely different era. We need businesses that bring purpose and responsibility into the heart of the way they're run. And it all goes down to how they're owned and therefore financed and governed.
Though it's such a complicated issue, isn't it? I'm just thinking it through here. We've got the city, which is one of our biggest industries in this country. And that is basically they want profit. And so they want to push companies to make profit. And then a lot of people like myself and stuff, we've got our investments to desperately try and make some money for when we retire. They're tied up. We want those guys to get our, you know, our shares to perform as best as possible. So I doubt Pepsi and Coke and Nike, actually Nike's, I sat in a talk with them recently. They're really going for sustainability, or they're pretending. I'm not sure which one it is. But a lot of those companies, you know, they're just going for profit. I'm not saying, by the way, I don't know the in-depth of Coke or Pepsi, but those companies, I imagine they're trying to get as much profit as possible, because, you know, and people are pushing them towards that.
Let's say, so, you know, I own shares, I've got some investments, as you said, but you're also a parent. And so do we really just want these companies to make the maximum profit? We want more than dividend returns from our investment. We want a habitable planet for our children and their children. So actually, there's been a really interesting rise in shareholder activism. People saying, oh, hang on, which actually writing to their pension fund or to their investment manager, saying, actually, I want you to tell me exactly which companies I do own shares in. Why have I got share? I might be going out on a march with Extinction Rebellion. Granny might say, I go and sit on bridges with Extinction Rebellion. And now you show me that I've actually got my pension invested in fossil fuel companies. Yeah. Take my money out of there. I don't want my money in there. And there's a really important and interesting rise of people who are saying, I only want my money to be invested in a legacy that I'm proud of. So there are some great companies coming through in renewable energy, in new kinds of transport, that people say, I'm proud to be investing in that, because those are the kind of things I do want to see growing. So I'd like to invest my money in that. And it probably actually, you know, the evidence is showing that these companies actually give better returns over the long term. They give stable and good returns, as opposed to the fossil fuel companies that are going to end up with what they call stranded assets. You're just going to end up with oil that you can't get out from the ground. Stop pretending that you're going to mine and burn all this stuff, because you can't. So put your money into a place where it's actually aligned with your values and you'll get a good return. And you'll be investing not only for the financial return of that company, but you'll actually be helping bring about the world that you want to leave as a legacy for your kids and grandkids.
Yeah, but then we also look at all the easiest ways to do it is, I think, the supermarkets. You go into the supermarket and there's suddenly a realization that because they're trying to make as much profit as possible, the apples they've got have been sitting around for 6 months in, I don't know how they do it. They put the fruit into hibernation somehow by putting oxygen in there or something. They can't be good for the environment. You've got your avocados flying all the way around the world and then being like gassed as well to keep them fresh. And, you know, then you've got the what I call lazy fruit. And I understand that people of disability need, and people and a lot of old people as well need fruit, which is prepared, and vegetables which are prepared. But people like, you know, it's not all for that. There's a lot of us use, you know, there's people who can't even bother to peel an orange anymore, so they're getting it ready peeled in single-use plastic. But, you know, Marks and Spencer's, Waitrose, whoever, the Tesco, Sainsbury's, they're doing it purely for the profit reasons, aren't they? They know it's a product and they know it can sell. So we've got a problem through the whole of society at the moment, haven't we, that people aren't quite, I think the public are on board with the ideas, but still the companies have got to try and generate profits. So that's why they're producing those products.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. We've come to expect raspberries in November, and we've come to expect a t-shirt for $3.99. And I think a lot of people, maybe naively, maybe understandably, tend to think, well, if it's on sale in this shop, then it must be okay. Otherwise, it wouldn't be here, right? I mean, it's legal. Surely things have been taken care of. And actually, things haven't been taken care of. You know, there's incredibly exploitative work going on in factories and households around the world of kids and contract workers stitching piece by piece, being paid a pittance to make that $3.99 t-shirt that we might buy, and I'm not quite sure if I like it. Well, it doesn't really matter. It's only $3.99. I can just throw it away. And that we expect fruit and veg, whatever we want from wherever in the world, all seasons. So it's part of a mindset that we, and I think it's been a century of consumer propaganda that has told us we can buy and have whatever we want at any time. This sense of constant, permanent availability and convenience. So there is absolutely in our own minds that need to think, why am I buying this and why do I think this should be available too? But those companies, as you say, they're trying to make a profit, and so they are selling whatever it is, and they've created this demand and created these expectations. And I think their own, because of the way they're run or owned, they need to pull back and say, actually, we're not going to sell things like that anymore. You see an increasing number of restaurants that say, actually, we're just serving localer food. Or a great cafe near where I live, it's a vegan cafe, and everybody wanted avocado mash on toast. And they just said, wow, we're just getting through so many avocados. They've just invented a brilliant alternative, kind of their own homemade green veg. It's like avocado, just a locally grown alternative. And we need to just learn to move away from those conveniences that the global supply chains tipped at the edges of our fingers for so long, because it made brilliant profits through the company's supply chains, but it doesn't work on this planet anymore. So yes, at our own personal level, and it's hard for us, you know, I love avocado. So yeah, I have to really think, how can I justify continually buying and eating avocados when I know they've been flown across the world? What else can I eat instead? And companies need to edit out some of the choices that they keep offering us. And that's a nice concept, you know, editing out, just not putting there, because if people think, well, it's on sale here, then it must be okay. So let's edit out the choices that don't make sense if we want to live on a thriving planet.
What's interesting, I work on I do a cooking show on a Sunday, or I'm one of the presenters on it, and the Michelin star chefs, which are still very popular, but the chefs which are becoming even more popular than that, the restaurants, are the ones where they're growing the produce, or they're foraging the produce. So the pig is one example. They grow everything there and people love it because it's actually grown in their gardens. And everything, every time you go there, it's a different menu because it's seasonal. So, you know, it's like and they talk to the gardeners and they say, what should we grow? And then they grow it and then they cook it, and they locate all their, they get all their food from local sources as well, their meat and everything. And people absolutely adore it. So that's why I think the public are ready for all these things. It's just, we just need the supermarkets, because you're right, it's the convenience thing as well. We need sort of Marks and Spencer, Waitrose or someone like that to go, right, no more single-use plastic. And everyone would go there because everyone would think, I'm doing that. But then the prices come up. And as you say in your in Donut Economics, it's you know, the people need their basic needs met. And it's getting harder and harder. But it seems to me, and I could get this wrong because I just, you know, read the media like everybody else, but it seems that the people have less money now. The companies have it all and it's all profits, and the people have less money and it's getting less. But is that just my perception of it, or is that an actual reality?
Well, definitely there's a huge cost of living squeeze happening to people in the UK. And I find it so shocking that this is one of the richest countries in the world, and we are richer than countries have been throughout human history. And yet we have so many people who have to go to food banks, so many people in this country who cannot afford the basics for their kids, for their uniform. What is going on? How can we have let our country come to this? And at the heart of Donut Economics, there are two dynamics that we talk about transforming in our economy, if we're going to get into that donut. We've inherited economies that are degenerative by design. We're running down the living world with single-use plastics, flying food all over the world, with applying too many chemicals, with throwing things away, right? Things are made, your smartphone or your tablet, if it breaks, oh, you get a new one. So we're running down the living world. We have to go from a degenerative world to a regenerative one, where we regenerate and reuse and we compost our food waste and we bring back the living world and we create a circular economy where things aren't used up, they're used again and again and again. That's half the story, from degenerative to regenerative. The other half of the story is about the social inequalities, because I think in this country particularly, we've inherited a really divisive economy where value and opportunity get channeled into the hands of a few people. And whether that's through inheritance, through regulation, through privilege, we just see the rise of a 1% and we see others just left without, and hugely economically vulnerable. And we need to move from a divisive society to a distributive one where opportunity and value is shared far more equitably with all who co-create it. What do I mean by that? Well, one of the first things that happened in COVID is everyone says, whose work is essential work? And actually it's the teachers and the caregivers and the doctors and the nurse and their work and the shelf stackers in the supermarket, their work is essential work. And why is it they're paid so little? And why is it they can't afford to live in the cities where they come and do this essential work? Why are their wages so low? And why is housing so expensive? So how can we create a society that's far more distributive, that pays far more decent wages to this work, but also is more affordable, where housing is affordable, where, you know, we provide good health and education and affordable public transport for everybody? That is totally possible. So we don't all need to own cars. That becomes possible when we think again about the ownership of housing. So the UK, let's take the City of London, or you could take many cities in the UK, huge squeeze on housing. Housing has become like an investment opportunity for investors from all over the world who have too much cash. They've accumulated so much money through their shares and in their investments. Oh, where shall I invest this? I hear housing is a good bet at the moment. I'll buy up some properties in London. I'll buy up some properties in Vancouver, in Amsterdam. I'll buy them up all over the world. So it's treated like it's an investment asset. Actually, housing is a human right. And the city of Vienna decided decades ago, because housing is a human right, they would treat it that way. The majority of housing in that city is owned by the city or by city-run cooperatives. And more than 60% of people in that city live in what we would call social housing. It's owned by the city. They pay an affordable rent. It's high quality. It's central and it's normal. And I just love the example of, say, like Vienna versus Vancouver, where rents are excruciatingly high and there's foreign investors from all over the world owning housing because it drives a good return. When we create the essentials of life, like housing and transport, when we make them affordable for everybody, we bring down the costs of living for everyone. So again, this goes to the deep design of the places where we live. How do we make it affordable to pay your rent and have a decent wage so that you're not pushed to the edge of a food crisis? and going to food banks.
The only problem with that, and I love the idea, and I've said on this podcast before a couple of times, shouldn't housing be a human right? And you're then relying on the government to provide social housing. Do you look at this lot? I mean, both the in power and in opposition. Do you think there's any possibility when all they do is shout and scream at each other constantly, and everyone who comes up with an idea, the opposition have immediately got to say it's a terrible idea, and this stupid power game which is being played out in our political system? Do you not? Are they capable of producing something as dramatic as that and life changing and, you know, society, such a massive societal change? Could they do that?
Well, I think at the heart of that, and I totally agree, we've got really oppositional politics in this country. And I think I said at the beginning of this conversation that shapes and pictures really matter. We've got a parliament where they sit in benches facing each other and bay at each other. If you go to another country, and I've been in parliamentary buildings around the world, they're often shaped in a horseshoe shape. It's much more conversational. It totally changes the relation between. And that's just symbolic of what I think is really problematic of the kind of two-party system that we've got in the UK, but it's actually not two parties. It's like five, six parties, but stuck in this first past the post. So yes, there's a lot deeply problematic. So one move sideways is to say, let's have a lot more rich, deliberative democracy spaces. And I think that's why we're seeing the rise of citizens' assemblies. Say in a town, they might randomly choose 100 citizens to be part of a conversation about how we're going to tackle climate change in the city. And the beauty there is that the people who get involved are from every walk of life, every level of education, every background. So they're bringing hugely diverse perspectives, but they are not trying to get reelected. So they're not performing to the camera. They're not performing and baying at the opposition. They are trying to do the best they can do on this job. And those citizens' assemblies often come up with far more practical but also radical propositions for what should happen in a place, because they're focused on the task rather than a four-year electoral cycle. But I did also want to say that it's not only should we have, you know, housing should be owned privately by private individual families or by landlords who can really own, you know, and hundreds of thousands of buildings and apartments in a city and wreak out the rent from families who can barely afford to pay. That's a private system gone to an extreme. It's not that the only alternative to that is that the state owns everything. And that, again, I think is part of donut economics, is realizing that there's a third space, which we can call the commons or the community space, where it's owned as a housing cooperative. It's owned by the members who are part of it, or it's a community land trust where community groups get given a piece of land for 99 years and they build housing. There's a great place in Leeds called LILAC. I think it stands for low impact, affordable communal living, where there's housing that's been built. It's really low carbon, low material use, really nice housing built with a central garden so all the kids can play. So there's the parenting bit, right? My kids can hang out with your kids, or I'm popping to the shops in that community raising a child. And people pay a percentage of their income to live there. So people are paying different levels of rent to live there because it's owned by the community. This is just one model. Hmm. What I'm saying here is there are so many different ways we can think about the ownership and financing of housing, and we've barely brushed the surface. And because we've inherited a kind of, is it privately owned or is it a rundown council house from a government that doesn't care? There are so many other options in between, and I think we're seeing lots of them rising up. And again, we think, what is the purpose of this housing? Who's living here and who's helping build it and look after it? How is this housing going to be governed? How is it owned? It's owned by us as the community. And that means it's financed in a completely different way, and we can charge differential rents. It just transforms what's possible when we open up the deep design of things.
Yeah, I love that idea. And you're also putting back community, which is always good. I'm just back on House of Commons, by the way, because I've interviewed a load of politicians about this. And I've always said I find it absolutely embarrassing for you all that you do that. I find your performance, I've been there, I got invited and I went to PMQs and I found the whole experience excruciating. We wouldn't let our children behave like that. We would not let them shout people down. We'd say, no, have a conversation. And yet we are allowing grown adults who are dealing with our life to just shout and scream at other. And their response is always, it's the one parliament in the world where you're held accountable. And I've got to say, bullshit on that, because even when you can lie to Parliament, as we recently found out, no one cares as long as you don't call each other a liar. I mean, it's nonsense in there, and it's pathetic. And if you are an MP and you're listening to this, and I hope you are, you need to do something to reform that, because it's embarrassing for you and embarrassing for our country that we've got this thing going on still.
But there are some also fantastic people who go into Parliament. I was a friend and a colleague of Jo Cox at Oxfam, and I'm so proud of what she did and went into Parliament. And, Caroline Lucas, there's a lot of people I could name, and a lot of good people who go into a system that's completely skewed and screwy, and they, in order to actually have an impact here, I have to start behaving like this. And I will say, I think a lot of people, good people, go into the world of business as well and realize, oh, in order to get a promotion here, I have to make the maximum profit. So it's the systems we design that make people behave in these completely insane ways.
They have people writing comedy lines for them. I mean, Jesus Christ, you're not comedians. None of you are talented at standing up and doing comedy, and yet you're in there trying to produce a comedy. Anyway, let's move on from there. Obviously, the big thing with the economy is taxation. It seems that the way our society is set up, I mean, globally, it's a problem, because people are obviously not paying taxes where their products are being sold. You know, like we hear Starbucks and things like that. But also, we're quite an old country, so we've got a lot of inherited wealth which is stored, you know, off out of the country, and then there's a lot in property, as you say. What should we be re-looking at the way the money is collected? I mean, as I said earlier, the people don't have the money. Is income tax, and is there any point to income tax anymore? You're just making everyone poorer. Isn't the real taxation in property, in foreign accounts and in company accounts?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think the debates that I've seen going on in politics recently around the cost of living crisis in the UK, the fuel costs going up, food costs going up, too often when you hear the politicians debate it and the government, they'll narrow the field as if the only options we have here are different kinds of taxes on the ordinary people, and shall we raise this or lower this? And it's like so much is left off the table. Why isn't there what's called a windfall tax, a one-off tax on the fossil fuel companies, who are right now making utterly extraordinary profits because the cost of fuel has gone so high. So they're like, "Woo, we never planned for this. This is a massive bonanza." Why are we not taxing that and using that completely unexpected profit to cover and alleviate the unexpected cost of living that ordinary families are facing? Why are we not, as you say, looking at wealth, at who owns the land and the buildings that year after year gives a rent, gives a return, rather than a wage, right? So I think we focus far too much on taxing wages rather than on looking at inherited wealth and the wealth that's wrapped up in land and housing and often offshored, as you say, saved in tax havens around the world, a lot of them enabled by the UK. So I think massive reform in the world of tax. When we have people who can earn extraordinary fortunes, not only does it kind of create this billionaires club that, you know, billionaires get sad when they're no longer on the Forbes top 10, they kind of get bumped down to number 12 and fall into utter depression. And this has been recorded, right? The kind of competitive accumulation amongst the super rich and what it means to have enough just goes through the roof. That means people start aspiring to lifestyles that this planet can't possibly afford, with private jets and luxury yachts and SUVs in every little town. We need to come way back within. So I think, just as the donut has leave no one in the hole and don't overshoot the limits, I think there's a really important role for public policy to bring us all back within what are reasonable limits. There's a wonderful word in Swedish that we don't have in English. They say it's lagom. In lagom in Sweden means I have plenty and it's enough. It's a kind of inherent sufficiency. It's a modesty of this is plenty for me. And it's interesting that we don't have a good word. Sufficiency sounds a bit kind of, it's just about enough. It's a generous word. If I have plenty and it's enough. And just as we need new pictures like the donut, we need new language, need new words to land back on this planet after a century of consumer propaganda that tells us you're doing well if your kids have a bigger house and a bigger income and more cars and more air miles than you did. It just won't work if we keep going like that. We have to come back within a sense of lagom.
The Stoics always say, desire what you have, not what you don't have, if you want a happy life. And I think, I've tried to take that on board, and it does work if you do that. And I think the billionaires could have a bit of that. I'm conscious we're running out of time, and there's just two topics, and I wonder if they're connected in any way that have made a huge impact on the world since I've been alive. And one of them being globalization has obviously become, a bigger aspect with all companies wanting to work in every aspect of the world. And the second one is the internet, which must have had the biggest impact on humans that there's ever been, bigger than print, bigger than anything. I mean, it's that and the nuclear bomb, I suppose, have had the biggest impact on us. Let's ask the question, how much impact has the internet had on our economy and the world economy?
Utterly transformative, and of course on our own heads, right? And raising kids in a generation where it's normal to be online, and we see the difference in the way we operate and the way. So before we come to the economy, just our attention spans, and think. Actually, no, that is about the economy, right? As they say, if the product is free, if the app is free, well, you are the product. It's your attention, and I think the film, The Social Dilemma, just does a brilliant job of helping us see that. We become the product and our attention becomes the product. So when we're continually scrolling through YouTube videos or clips and Insta this and that, our attention is being sold to the advertisers. So the internet at one level has made us a product in the economy of selling our attention and selling our interests and our data to these companies. And then secondly, the rise of online sales, the rise of the digital is an incredible tool, right? Here's me and you sitting having this conversation because of this equipment. Thank you, internet. Thank you. It connects us with, my work, Donut Economics Action Lab, I'm talking to cities and communities and teachers all over the world every day. And we're doing this transformative work through the internet. So it's incredible. But of course, like any technology, how it's owned and financed and governed and purposed has a huge impact on how we then use it. And some massive companies have sprung up that have mastered and captured these big digital networks, and COVID supercharged that because of all of our shopping went online. So we're seeing these, again, the rise of these mega billionaires who are owning and driven by the tech. I'm really inspired by the work of some folks who are working on reclaiming the space of internet. It doesn't have to be a private stack of private apps and private companies owning private hardware and software and owning kind of private protocols. We can create what they call public stack, as in, again, just like we can have community land trust, it doesn't have to be the market or the state. There's a community owned space. There are open source, open design and community owned apps and websites and software and protocols and technologies. So I really like to think we're still in the very early days of the internet. And these early days, the story begins that it began as an open public shared space, and then it got really captured and enclosed, and it got turned into a tool for hypercapitalism. And that's where we are right now. And it doesn't have to be the end of the story. It can now be reinvented through people actively leaving the apps that are being bought up by billionaires and turned into toys and tools for them, to going to apps and platforms that are actually being designed as cooperatives, as community, as purpose-driven. So as with any technology, ask, what is its purpose? How is it networked with the others? How is it governed? How is it owned? And how is it financed? And these five questions just can make you like a detective, an economic detective about any organization or institution. And if you understand that, you can start to see what they have the potential to do and be in the world. We need to redesign the deep design of enterprise if we're going to repurpose it so it helps bring us into the donut.
Finally, Kate, are you optimistic about the future?
Well, I often will say, do not be an optimist if it makes you sit back and say, oh, we've got this. to write in, because you know, like people are ingenious and we've solved things before and they said there was a crisis before. It's okay. Technology is going to sort it. Do not be an optimist if it makes you sit back and do that. But also, don't be a pessimist if it makes you give up and say it's too hard, we are too many, it's too late, it's too big, it's too complex. Because if we give up and say that, then we just make it true. So don't be an optimist if it makes you relax. Don't be a pessimist if it makes you give up. Be in action. Every single one of us is powerful and influential with our own networks, right? A 17-year-old girl can talk to other 17-year-old girls all over the world and motivate them and mobilize them in a way that no old man can. And an old guy in the pub can talk to his friends and actually motivate them to get solar panels on their roof or to change the way they're thinking or move their money and switch banks and divest from that pension fund. He can influence his mates in a way that no 17-year-old can get close to. So each one of us is really powerful. And one powerful thing that research shows us is that people are most motivated by what their peers are doing, right? Should I own a car or not? Should I fly on distant holidays or not? What are my neighbors doing? Oh, that's interesting. Several people in my street have switched that. Oh, look, I'm seeing electric cars popping up. I'm seeing more people using the car sharing scheme. We are motivated by what those around us are doing. So you don't have to shout about it. Just if you start living a different way, we are quietly influencing each other. I went vegan a year ago. And every time I go in a restaurant, I can see like meat, 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 meat. You know, there's a social embarrassment of like, nothing that I want is on the menu. But I think, I'll just quietly ask because this waiter or waitress must get this several times. So I'll really nicely say, I'm vegan. Do you have anything you can give me? At some point, they're going to go into the kitchen and say, like, I've had five vegans come in today. Can we just put something vegan on the menu? And that, so it's that feeling of there's social resistance to it. But you know what? Let's just open up a new path quietly, gently, with a smile, just show that there's a different way of living. So be in action.
Yeah, it's up to us to do it as well. Kate, thank you so much for joining me today. I love your book, Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. I recommend to anyone to read it. And it made me happy reading this, actually, because I do think I spend a lot of my time banging on to my friends going, it doesn't have to be this way. We can change things. And everyone just seems to really be stuck in there. No, this is the way it is. You know, that's the mentality of a lot of people. If people wanted to follow you to find out more of it, is there a website or social media, which is the best way to do it?
So I'm on Twitter. I'm just on Twitter at my name, Kate, at Kate Raworth. But what I would really love people to know is that since my book came out in 2017, the thrilling thing for me is that so many people started coming up to me saying, yeah, love the book, but I want to do this. I'm teaching this in my classroom. I'm taking this to my community group. I'm taking this to my town hall, to my city council. I'm taking this into my startup. And so we've created Donut Economics Action Lab for people all around the world who literally just started doing it. They couldn't resist putting these ideas in practice. And it's thrilling to me. So we're at donuteconomics.org. You can see what's going on in the Action Lab. We create tools for cities and for communities and for teachers and for businesses. And they're in the commons. I was talking about the commons. They're in the commons. And we just ask that people show reciprocity. So you're welcome to use them. Just share back your innovations because we know that we influence each other massively. And people are so inspired by what their peers are doing. So from Amsterdam to Barcelona to Leeds to Glasgow to Birmingham, there is amazing stuff happening in cities. And I'm just thrilled to see them inspiring one another. So yeah, please check it out. Join the Action Lab. Let's put these ideas into practice.
Yeah, that's great. And donut, by the way, is spelt the British way, not the...
a very British way, yes.
The, not the American way, yes. So D-O-U-G-H-N-U-T. Thank you so much, Kate. Thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Tim.
Thank you.
Cheers.